this being, you know, this holiday weekend, that it might be useful for us to reflect together on this event, and then also on the broader question of violence and war and peace, both socially and internationally, and also internally. So the origins of this holiday came after the Civil War. And Civil War was the deadliest war in American history insofar as the number of Americans who were killed. And that includes both military and civilian. Okay. So some years after the war was over, there arose this tradition. It was called Decoration Day. And on that day, the friends or relatives or anyone in the community who wanted to would go to the graves of people who were killed in the Civil War and put flowers on them, okay, decorate them with flowers. Okay. And family members and others might, when they visit the graveyard, they would also have maybe a little picnic, something to eat together. So the entire event was to honor the war dead. It was a national day of mourning. Okay. There was no element of it in the outset that had anything at all to do with the glorification of war. You know, now it's become like any other national holiday. It's a kind of a national day of shopping, and it has to do with celebrating of material acquisitions, you know. The holiday that initiates the summer season, the time for people to go out and play. To almost any combat veteran I know, and I'm being one myself, I don't know a single one who finds there to be any positive purpose at all in the glorification of war. That it is indeed a time of mourning. Okay. That to really honor those who died, who were killed in uniform in the service to our country, is to acknowledge the great tragedy that occurred, that arose in their in our society, in our choice to go to war. Congress intended it to be kind of difficult for the United States to go to war. You can't officially do so without there being an act of Congress authorizing it. And such a declaration of war also has the effect of transferring massive amounts of discretionary authority to the executive branch that it doesn't normally have. Of the 10 major military conflicts that the United States has been involved in since the adoption of our Constitution, do you know how many of those 10 conflicts were declared wars?
Three.
Actually, five. You can count them on one hand, right? Not too many. So these other war actions, you know, Korea wasn't a war. It was a police action, you know, and it was ostensibly being carried out by the United Nations against the North Koreans, and our commanding general directly disobeyed the orders of the president and invaded North Korea, and which brought in the Chinese. And although the United States, you know, supplied 90% of the manpower and almost 100% of the weaponry. And that one didn't work out terribly well, you know, it fought to a stalemate. And we just couldn't lose our taste for ground wars in Asia. So we, you know, a few years later, decided it was going to be a really good idea to do the same thing in Vietnam. The Vietnam War was ostensibly started by something called the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964. And then President Johnson went to Congress and asked them to adopt the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And that was Congress's authorization for the raising of money and the mounting of a military conflict against the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. Later historians showed that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was written 6 weeks before the Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred. That it had been the intention all along of the Johnson administration to invade South Vietnam. And they were just waiting for what looked like an appropriate opportunity. Two American destroyers were thought to have been fired upon in the night. Turns out one of them was one destroyer firing on the other one by accident, by mistake, you know. About 20% of the casualties, the injured and the dead in all wars that have ever been fought are what's called friendly fire. It's people that die in accidents, it's people that die because mistakes were made within one's command. Jeanette Rankin, the first female member of Congress from California, once observed, no one wins a war just like no one wins an earthquake. Mostly what I want to focus on this evening, however, are the teachings of both the Buddha and a ancient Chinese military strategist, a general who is widely regarded to be the best military strategist in world military history. There's a fellow named Sun Tzu. Lived in the 5th century of the Common Era, at a time when China was undergoing, it's called the Era of State War. There was these civil wars that went on between the different nation states in China that lasted for the better part of the century. And Sun Tzu's treatise on war, called The Art of War, starts off pretty much like Jeanette Rankin's observation, you know. He said, war is a disaster. War represents the greatest failing of human character there is. Okay. War represents a failure of leadership, a failure of insight, a failure of perception, a failure to conceive of how to achieve one's goals without having to resort to violence. Several hundred years earlier, you know, and by this time Buddha Dharma had come to China, the Buddha said the same thing. He said, your greatest enemy is your own mind, untrained and in turmoil. While the mind at peace and disciplined and uncraving is your greatest friend and protector. Right. So that was Sun Tzu's starting point, insofar as in his book sometimes has been translated the title The Art of Strategy. So sometimes the one, you know, if one is responding to aggression, sometimes armed conflict is the only possible course of action. But those situations are extremely rare. You know, Sun Tzu observes that nearly all wars are initiated by the forces of greed, hate, and delusion. That a society is unable to control in its leaders, if indeed the entire society itself is so afflicted. And so Sun Tzu says the greatest strategists are those who perceive the origins of conflict at their very earliest stages and are able to change the situation in order to keep conflict from arising. This is Thomas Cleary's translation of The Art of War. According to an old story, a lord of ancient China was once asked his physician, a member of the family of healers, which of them was the most skilled in the art. The physician, whose reputation was such that his name became synonymous with medical science in China, replied, my eldest brother sees the spirit of sickness and removes it before it takes shape. So his name never gets out of the house. My elder brother cures sickness when it is still extremely minute. So his name does not get out of the neighborhood. For me, I puncture veins, prescribe potions, massage skin, and so from time to time my name gets out and is heard among the lords. Among the tales of ancient China, none captures more beautifully than this the essence of the art of war, the premier classic of science of strategy and conflict. A Ming Dynasty critic writes of this little tale of the physician, what is essential for leaders, generals, and ministers in running countries and governing armies is no more than this. The healing arts and the martial arts may be a world apart in ordinary usage, but they are parallel in several senses. In recognizing, as the story goes, that the less that is needed, the better. In the sense that both involve strategy in dealing with disharmony. And in the sense that in both knowledge of the problem is key to its solution. As in the story of the ancient healers and Sun Tzu's philosophy, the peak efficiency of knowledge and strategy is to make conflict altogether unnecessary. To overcome others' armies without fighting is the best of skills. So I, much earlier in life, was quite taken with the Chinese martial arts. And I joined a Shaolin temple in Albany, California, where we lived. And the first, they taught what are called the five noble arts. The first one is Tai Chi, which is a defensive martial art. Okay. And it's one in which, through very slow, fluid movements, the mind-body is trained to create an aura of invincibility around oneself. It's a defensive martial art. And so different ways to ward off or neutralize aggressive moves that are coming toward you. Okay. And ways to use the opponent's strength and aggression against them. Okay. And the second of the noble arts was Gung Fu. And many of the moves in Gung Fu, it takes about 40, 45 minutes to do the Tai Chi form. And in a Gung Fu routine, you do almost the same routine. In some schools, you do almost the same routine as in Tai Chi, but you do it in less than 2 minutes. So you, it becomes that you're like when someone's really coming at you, that they're kind of walking into a buzzsaw. but, you know, better not to have to do it at all, you know, if you can. Okay. The other three of the five noble arts are acupressure, massage, the meridians, herbs, using of herbal remedies for the healing of joints and things of that nature, and calligraphy. Right, calligraphy, yeah. Yeah, to communicate in writing in the same way, using, you know, the simplest approach with the least amount of effort. Okay, so, you know, I took my training in these things about 40 years ago, and the only time I've ever used it, other than to keep from being hit in the face by a door, was when my wife and I were living in Catalonia, in Spain, in Barcelona, for on sabbatical for a few weeks. And one day, we were living in a slightly edgy part of town, just off La Rambla. And one day we were approached by a pickpocket, and we didn't know it at the time. And he first asked for a light for his cigarette and moved in closer and closer. And then he held out his hand to shake hands. And we, being dumb American tourists, you know, most Europeans don't do that. It's not part of their greeting ritual. So he reached out his hand, I just kind of instinctively, and then he grabbed me and pulled himself in, tried to knock me down and take my briefcase that was slung over my shoulder. And so just really quite automatically, I just planted a back foot and thrust him off. And then he just ran away, you know. So it can be a very useful thing to have, and the nature of that event, you know, it worked just as it was supposed to. You know, it just prevented harm, and then the harm left. Okay. So the purpose of diplomacy is basically to follow Sun Tzu's advice, you know, that often takes more courage and skill to keep nascent conflicts from becoming unmanageable than it does to fight a war once it's begun. But it's also necessary to make it clear that combat remains a possibility, so the adversary does not mistake peaceful intent for cowardice. The way Sun Tzu's real genius, the thing that he was most famous for and best known for, was commanding numerically inferior forces, was coming up against a force that was larger than his. Okay. And traditionally what would happen is that the superior force and the lesser force would just meet on the field of battle and slug it out, and you know, more often than not, the superior force would win. And so his approach instead was, when encounter was about to occur, it was nearly always to fall back, okay, and to invite the superior force in to go to the attack, you know, because what he understood, he said, it has to do with being able to read the mind of the other and to read your own mind as well. So he said, the numerically superior force, oftentimes its leaders and its officers are imbued with greed, hate, and delusion. You know, they are making the aggressive move. They are going on the attack out of greed. They're trying to seize the property, the goods, the lands, the wealth of the other. So that is their motivation. And if their motivation is greed, they can't, it's really hard to rally around the flag of greed. You know, it's kind of an ignoble motivation. And so instead, what they had to do was to denigrate, demonize the other side in order to then make it possible to motivate their armies to destroy them. Okay. So they cultivated hatred of the other in addition to greed for their goods. And then they had to create among the society as well the delusory view that they were in peril, and the only way to become safe and secure was to destroy the other. Okay. And so he would see these advancing armies, and he could understand their motivations and their intentions. And he didn't use the word mindfulness, but he said, It is absolutely compulsory that you know yourself and your own motivations, and that you be able to be peaceful and calm, which is what's taught in both Tai Chi and Kung Fu. You know that everything you do emanates from a quiet center. Okay. That just like the Buddha said, the mind untrained and in turmoil becomes your own worst enemy. So if you're angry, enraged, if you hate the other, you know, and you lust after what they have, that it creates blindness, it creates the inability to fully understand what's going on. And then, in his strategy, that's what you do. You allow them to overextend. You allow them to put their full force into the field, okay? And then arrange yourself so you can absorb that full force, but not in an overtly confrontational way, so that they begin to expend their energy in what they thought was going to be an easy victory. Okay, and you fall back and you fall back, and then once the forward forces are far forward, okay, then you begin to close in and you begin to take them out, you know, one at a time, because they have allowed their own aggression to imbalance them. Same is true in one-on-one martial arts. Okay. If, to the extent that you're able to entrain the anger and the lust for victory from the other side, you're on the path to victory. You know? Sun Tzu said, in war, there may be victors, but there are no winners. He said, a war leaves the earth despoiled. It's been poisoned by the blood of those who died in killing each other. Right? So that the overall effect for this is, and the Buddha said just the same thing, you know, right? He said, in war there are no winners. The defeated have lost because they are now oppressed by the victors. The victors have lost because they fear the defeated, and they must ever oppress them in order to protect themselves. Tocqueville made exactly the same observation about the slave states in the South. He said the slaveholders are as much slaves as the slaves themselves. They're enslaved by the system of slavery, by the continuing need to oppress in order to maintain their wealth. You know, really, really interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. I remember after I came home from Vietnam, in 1967, I was out there in the pretty early days of the war, and I got involved in the anti-war movement and started paying close attention to the debates that were going on in Congress over whether to continue the war or not, or whether we'd maybe kind of blown it. It was going to be best if we could just kind of say, well, that was fun, but you know, I think it's time for us to go do something else now. And one of the most powerful arguments in favor of the war that was always given in these debates in Congress, you know, they would say, we must not fail in our purpose until we have achieved final victory. For to cease fighting now would mean that those who have been killed, their lives will have been lost in vain. We must honor the memory of our fallen by moving onward to victory. Okay. By that time, about 35,000 American servicemen and women had been killed in Vietnam. And so that argument prevailed for several more years. By 1975, when the war came to an end, it was not 35,000 American servicemen and women who had been killed in Vietnam, it was 58,000. Okay. So twice as many people lost their lives in vain because of that war than would have necessarily been the case if we'd stopped at an earlier time, you know, in pursuit of it was Sun Tzu's teaching. Just over and over and over again. Now, of course, at West Point, Art of War is required reading as a way of saying, oh, well, maybe those people had something to say back then, you know, and we should really reflect on these things before we move forward. I recently, just a few days ago, a couple days ago, came home from a meditation retreat with Guy Armstrong and Carol Wilson down at Kelly Place. If you have an opportunity to do that retreat sometimes, it's both a beautiful place and they're very skilled teachers, and they teach down there every May. And what I realized on that retreat was the same thing that happens on every retreat that I've gone on for the last 40 years, which is that especially the first few days are difficult. Okay. And there's difficult because there is quite a lot of internal conflict that's going on, you know. One of the things that makes Dharma study and Dharma practice pretty difficult at the beginning is because it is the self, the sense of self, when we undertake the study of Buddha Dharma and we're taught that, you know, the source of suffering or the source of dissatisfaction in life is craving, you know, craving and clinging, craving for things to be different than they are. Either craving something we want and don't have, or craving that the situation be different because there's something that's going on in our lives that we don't want to have happening. It's difficult or painful. So when we go on retreat, or in daily life, when the difficult stuff comes up, the things we don't want to look at, you know, by and large, we have an array of what we think of as pretty successful strategies for dealing with the difficult, which is to ignore it, you know, or pretend it's not going on, watch television, eat and drink, do anything to distract ourselves so we don't have to really examine carefully the difficult that's arising in the mind. What happens when you go on a retreat, and I will forewarn you, is that the setting being what it is, you go in there and you vow not to do the things you normally do to avoid suffering. You agree, you vow to just be with what is. So you're in a setting, a place of sanctuary, a place of refuge, where you have food to eat and you have lodging, and you have these vows that we take where we co-create a place of refuge so that we treat each other with kindness and don't take each other's stuff and don't hit on each other and you know, don't engage in unskillful speech and don't take intoxicants, you know. So these are all things necessary to create safe spiritual community. And then within that, since the retreats are in silence, we have this opportunity just to watch the mind continuously produce whatever it is it's going to produce. And so we can have really hard or unpleasant mind states come up, you know, that are really where there's like powerful aversion, you know, anger or fear or anxiety or something like that. We can have mind states come up that are really imbued with lust or unrequited desire of some kind or another. Spend days and days, or at least, you know, several settings, longing for that which we don't have. Okay. All the while, what we're training the mind to do is to be with the unpleasant without aversion, and to be with the pleasant without attachment. Okay. Training the mind in the ways of peace. We're training the mind to feel some sense of equanimity. The problem that we have in the early days of a retreat is that we try to use the power of the self to combat the arising of self. Okay. We have memories of unpleasant, you know, unwholesome things we've said or done that have caused suffering to ourselves or others, or difficult mind states that arise a lot, you know, whether it's depression or anxiety or just dislike of the other, right? And the self, you know, when we first hear these teachings, well, I've got to stop craving, you know, I've got to stop feeling aversion, I've got to stop, you know, delusive thinking, you know, I can do these things. And so the self tries to make the self stop being aversive and stop craving, you know, and to see clearly. And it's absolutely impossible to do. The Buddha, you know, who was teaching from a place of enlightenment, that never happened for him. He continued craving, you know, aversion, thoughts, you know, feelings of aversion, feelings of craving, you know, the tendency toward deluded thought arose in him. He even gave this, well, the classic Pali term for this is the kalesas, or torments of mind. Okay. Three poisons, they're also sometimes called. Okay. The Buddha gave his a nickname. He called it Mara, the tempter, right? And he would talk about, you know, like sitting in meditation, reflecting, and seeing the arising of the kalesas, see them come up. And he would just, when he would see them arising, he would just say, "I see you, Mara." And then they would dissipate. They'd melt away. Sometimes he would describe sort of Mara kind of slinking off into the shadows because he'd been discovered. He'd been seen for who he was. Okay. So on retreat or in practice generally, what we're doing is training the mind to make peace with the arising of the difficulty, which is very different. You know, we're not combating it. We're not using self to attack self, the things that we don't like about self. We realize that that's something that the self is absolutely incapable of doing. Okay. But there is this inner wisdom that we have that is capable of it. Right? Not through trying to suppress it or make it go away, but rather simply by recognizing it for what it is and allowing it to arise and change and pass away. You know, when we do this choiceless awareness practice, that's what we're doing. Jack Kornfield's 1994 book, really wonderful book, kind of deep introduction to Theravada Buddhist meditation practices. It's called A Path with Heart. One of the very earliest chapters in there is called Stopping the War Within. And that's what he's talking about, you know, making peace with yourself. And for many of us, making peace with ourselves involves making peace with our own memories. Okay. Sun Tzu observed, you know, he said, if you know others and know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles. If you know yourself, but do not know others, you will win one and lose one. If you do not know others and do not know yourself, you will be imperiled in every single battle. So this ability to know what's going on, you know, see clearly what's going on, what's going on in ourselves, what's going on in others, makes it possible for this state of inner peace to begin to arise. Because we recognize the sort of automatic and impersonal nature of the kilesas, the craving and the clinging and the aversion and the delusion. Okay, and we come to realize that it's hardwiring in the mind. And when we seek to fight against it or oppose it, we fuel it. We make it stronger. And the way we simply allow it to be there, make peace with it, in a way that gradually disempowers it, makes it weaker, makes it have less ability to influence our words and our deeds, is simply by being with it in an accepting and a self-compassionate way. And then inevitably that process begins to work. Okay. Then we can become mindful of the early symptoms of incipient conflict, either within ourselves or with another. Okay. And it becomes possible to follow Sun Tzu's advice, you know, to make peace with the other, to make peace with ourselves, and to cease being at war, either with others or with ourselves. So there's a book that's recently come out by a really wonderful meditation teacher and scholar named Gil Fronsdale. And the title of the book is The Buddha Before Buddhism. And what it is his translation and commentary on perhaps the most ancient of the texts, the transcripts of the very first written transcripts of the Buddha's discourses. It's called the Book of Eights. It's found in the Kutaka Nikaya. In the Book of Eights, some of the Buddha's very earliest teachings, okay, there is no mention of rebirth. There is no mention of the kind of system of spiritual scorekeeping that later cropped up in the Theravada, you know, stream entry and the four stages of enlightenment and all that sort of thing. There is next to no discussion of doctrines of any form at all. What there is a lot of discussion of is peace and non-clinging. And it's not by reference to, you know, a particular set of doctrines. It's by reference to the behavior of who we call the wise, okay? Sages. The word for sage in Pali is Muni, okay? The name for the historical Buddha was Shakyamuni, which is to say a sage of the Sakya clan, okay? That's who he was. He was one of these sages, one of these who has this inner wisdom. And so he's just kind of describing the sage. You know. This is one who has conquered drowsiness and laziness and sluggishness, does not live negligently, a person intent on full release, not conceited, not pulled into false speech or enamored with physical forms. Understanding conceit and refraining from a violent life. One shouldn't delight in the old or prefer the new, grieve for what's lost or cling to what's attractive. Greed I call the great flood, and desire a swift current. Objects of awareness are moving waves, and lust is a quagmire difficult to cross. Not deviating from truth, sages, Brahmins stand on dry ground, giving up everything. They are said to be at peace. Knowing they are the ones who know, knowing the Dharma, they are not dependent. Wandering properly through the world, they do not envy anyone here. They have overcome lust, a clinging hard to overcome in this world. They don't grieve or worry. They have cut the stream and they are unbound. What was before, let it wither away. What will be later, do nothing with it. Not grasping what's in between, you will live in peace. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Memorial Day. We can mourn the ways that we have caused suffering for ourselves or others, and the losses that may have ensued as a result of it. In Buddha Dharma, there is careful languaging around the concepts of guilt and remorse. And in the early days of the retreat, many of us will find ourselves feeling guilt, feeling badly about ourselves for things that we have done that have caused discord or harm, either to ourselves or others. And what that is a negative form of selfing. It's a negative form of egotism because it's based on a sense of self, a sense of self that is bad and inferior and undeserving of love or positive regard. Gradually over the course of doing practice, one becomes less attached to these feelings, because you have begun to let go of the sense of a permanent and abiding self, and you have come more to recognize that the self is a moment-to-moment construct, that we conjure the self. We bring it up, you know. And what happens usually first is the arising of aversion or the arising of greed, and then we construct a self around it. Okay. And so in this case, we constructed a self around the regrets, around the unwholesome or unskillful that we've done or that others have done. When you can begin to let go of the self, you see it for the empty phenomenon that it is. You see the arising of the memory of something said or done that's unskillful. And you can look back on it not with guilt, but with remorse. And the remorse is looking back at it and offering some understanding and compassion. Say, oh, look who I was when I did that thing. Look at the suffering that I was in. Look at the way aversion and anger had overcome my consciousness, had overcome the mind, and what I said or did as a result. Look at the way that fear or rage overcome me, had overcome me. Look at the way that obsessive craving had overcome me and caused me, the craving self who arose at that time, to do what I did. Okay. When you can see, you kind of detach from what happened, not take it literally so personally, right? But simply see that what you said or did was an arising of causes and conditions at that point in time that caused that particular outcome. When you can clearly see that, it makes it so much less likely that you're going to do that in the future. That's the real value of remorse, right? Because you can clearly see this cause-effect relationship between that behavior and its outcome. You know, the unhappy fruit that it bore, right? And you see clearly how not to do it again. What was before, let it wither away. What will be later, do nothing with it. Not grasping what's in between, you will live in peace. Well, I've gone and gobbled up most of our time, but we have about 10 minutes left for some discussion. So I would really appreciate hearing from anybody, either with a question or just a reflection on any thoughts that may have arisen for you or memories while I was speaking.
I really like what you just said, that last piece, that it's the arising and then the self constructs around that. That's something.
Big owie. Yeah. we have a sort of a tradition in my home, which is that every Mother's Day, we buy my wife this great big hanging plant, okay, and it hangs on a rafter on our back porch, just outside the back door, near where we have our recycling bins. And usually for about the first 2 or 3 weeks after it's up there, every time I go out to do some recycling, go bam, you know, walk right into this thing, you know, hits me right between the running lights, hurts a lot, you know, it's like. And then the next time I do it, bam, whoa, that really hurt this time, you know. I wonder how much longer it's going to take me to remember that that thing is there, you know. And so it is in a similar way with when we see, you know, these unskillful behaviors come up. You know, bam, that really hurt, you know. I wonder if I can remember not to do that again. I wonder if I can remember that that big old hanging plant's there now. And I need to find a different path, you know. And after you've suffered enough, you start to get the hang of it a little bit, you know. Well, maybe if I don't speak like that or act like that in future, I won't suffer as a result. I mean, it sounds well, duh, you know. But sometimes it can really take a while for that to seep in, you know, and for the knowledge to really find a home in your consciousness. Please, anyone else? Yes.
As I continue to like play with like remorse and like being gentle around things.
Yes.
When things happen, I notice this odd sensation that happens where, and I can't tell if it's like because of societal pressure.
Yes.
To like feel guilty, mm-hmm. But I notice this sensation that the only word that I can think to even describe it is almost like. I ask myself, am I numb? Like I've experienced depression before.
Yeah, of course.
And it's almost like a similar sensation of like this, like, oh, like, because I'm noticing that I'm more easily able to like overcome things.
Yes.
But it's like this odd thing where I notice that people seem weird about it.
Uh-huh.
And I keep like wondering, like, oh, am I depressed or am I numb? And then I check in and I'm like, no, I feel great. Like, I'm really content in my life. But it's this like odd thing that's happening. And I just, and it's like reminding me of like what we're talking about, of this like remorse, but it's like this odd thing that keeps happening. And so
right.
I was curious if anybody else had that experience.
Well, what it brings to mind for me is the way we are conditioned as in this culture from very early childhood.
Okay.
And a powerful tool for behavioral control and behavior modification among children is to make them feel bad about themselves. Mm. You know, so bad, bad boy, bad girl, sometimes accompanied by corporal punishment. You know. And using the withdrawal of parental affection or, and creating a sense of unsafety, of threat, of always being on guard, of always being afraid of being harmed in your home, in a place where you shouldn't, you know. You go to school, it's the same thing. You know, you do your classwork and whatnot, and you get graded. You know, if you do things the way the teacher thinks you should be, you get a high grade, and if you don't, you get a low grade, you know. So you go through your entire life, growing up, being judged. And sometimes, somewhere along the way, you start to internalize that. You know, when we don't have any more parents, or we don't have a teacher or somebody around to do that, we start doing it to ourselves. You know, we have this notion that this is how I'm going to become a good person, by treating myself cruelly, right? This is not a universal way to raise children. There are many cultures in which the norm is to raise children from the very early stages feeling good about themselves, feeling that they're whole, feeling that they're valuable, that they have worth, that they're loved. And when they do things that are out of harmony, to have that be pointed out. You know, to point out when you do that, you cause harm to yourself and you cause harm to others. You don't really want to be doing that, do you? It's a very different kind of a way, you know. The former way that I was describing is particularly a hallmark of authoritarian cultures, okay? And it's particularly a hallmark of warlike cultures, okay? Because it instills a sort of military kind of discipline over one's behavior. It makes them easier to control through the use of intimidation and fear. And so part of, and that was going certainly going on in the Buddha's time, you know, he had this community of renunciates, and they had these rules that they sought to live by, but if somebody blew it, they didn't chew each other out. You know, they'd realize that something was amiss, one would go and apologize to the other, okay? Or if they really couldn't quite get it together, they'd go to the Buddha and ask for, you know, him to serve as a mediator or arbitrator and kind of sort things out, you know? So they were, in their community, they were practicing peace. They were practicing forgiveness. They were practicing compassion. And that's why sometimes what we do in Buddha Dharma Sanghas is called going against the grain or going against the stream. Because it is certainly against the cultural stream in which we've been raised. Now we have gone and used up all our time. So I'd appreciate it if you would once again take your sitting posture for just a moment. And once again, allow the eyes to gently close. Knowing they are the ones who know, knowing the Dharma, they are not dependent, these sages, wandering properly through the world. They do not envy anyone here. What was before, let it wither away. What will be later, do nothing with it. Not grasping what is in between, you will live in peace. Thanks for coming around. It's, you know, as a veteran, it's always funny when somebody wishes me Happy Memorial Day, you know, yeah, or Happy Veterans Day, you know, in November. So if we can remember, this is a time of solemn remembrance, honoring those who have passed, honoring their sacrifice, but not celebrating it. Please, have a good week.